welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Sitting across from me in the studio this week is West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis. And if you've got a question for our program during the next half hour, you can phone that in to 496-1999. You can email your questions to ask@WBAA.org, and you can tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, first, I guess congratulations are in order. Nobody felt they wanted to challenge you for your job for the next 4 years. So yeah, congrats.
It was funny. My wife called me up that evening, and I told her I gave my acceptance speech to my dog because there was nobody else in the room. And the dog received it very well. Her tail was wagging, and she was panting heavily. So I think Abby approved my next 4 years here, I guess.
Well, a tail wagging is a good thing to get from your constituents, right?
I suppose.
Well, I wanted to start with our listener questions. Sarah Poor had written in saying, I know that TAF is responsible for most of the public art and murals in town, and those are chosen via applications. But how do you pick places for new murals? She says, I know of a few places that could desperately use one, particularly the ramp to North River Road just off of Wiggins and Salisbury. How could we get this submitted for a potential future mural project? She'd like to know.
Well, usually what we do is obviously she's 100% correct about the TAF involvement, but the private sector involvement usually requires the owner of the property to go ahead and relinquish that for that specific purpose for us to go ahead and put some sort of public art there. And a lot of that gets into the cost, and then even more importantly, gets into the maintenance. With some of the artwork that we use, it's not always just a mural. Sometimes it's more interactive, and that can cut into some expense. So we usually have to have a cooperative property owner. If it's public property, then it gets down to who actually has authority over that property. If it's state stuff, we have to go ahead and get approval from the state. If it's local, obviously, we can do it internally either through our legislative body or through me.
So you have the ability to approve some of these things?
Mm-hmm. Some of these things I do, yeah. If it's city property, we can go ahead and work with let's say hypothetically it's something within our park system. We could go ahead and, you know, through the validation of the parks board, go ahead and get that done pretty quickly. Or if it's other city property, then we can go ahead and just do it, you know, with some sort of understanding through my office.
If you have questions for West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis today, you can phone us at 496-1999. Email questions to ask@WBAA.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Always a good idea to get in early in the show so we have plenty of time to address your questions. I wanted to get back to something we haven't talked about in a couple of months, which is City Hall.
Oh, yeah.
What's the latest on the mold-riddled building?
Well, the mold is growing very well. We've done a great job
of
creating almost a
petri
dish environment in there, and it's growing very well. No, the fact of the matter is that we've been going through a methodical process of making sure we get all the usable items out of the building. The lower level prior to the second flood was used for document storage, so we've removed most of the documents of importance from there. The property that we've needed to relocate to where we are temporarily now in Morton's been for the most part, handled. Now what we're looking at is a demolition date. We are intending.
So it is definitely going to be torn down.
Yes, yes. So we've allocated the funding to take the building down because right now it's not just an eyesore, but it's becoming somewhat of a hazard. One of the reasons that we were using to either reinvest in the building or relocate was the fact that some of the bricks were falling down and it wasn't ADA accessible. And actually a ramp that was an ADA accessible ramp that was added on the north side of the building about 20 years ago was actually starting to fall away from the building. And that's not a good thing. So we feel that it's incumbent upon us to go ahead and sort of remediate the site, get the building off of it. And then we will start. This year is actually the year that we do our strategic plan update. So we're going to use that as a primary focal point for that conversation to see really, and again, you've heard me say this 100 times before, so I apologize to you specifically, Stan, for those in the audience as well. But we're going to start doing our strategic plan update and have sensing sessions with the understanding that we want to know what the citizens want City Hall A to be. You know, what is City Hall? What does that concept mean now? We believe that it's not just the housing of local, you know, elected officials or employees. And be where it wants, where they would like to see it. And a lot of the public speaking that I do, a lot of folks are pretty open about letting me know what their thoughts are. But we'll do that more of a formal setting just to see, you know, what it is people want of City Hall and where they want it to be. Quite clearly, We are in a position with some of the available city spaces on the north end of town to look at that as an option. And then also we are currently in the Morton building, and that's another building that's going to need some significant attention, both financially and otherwise on the part of the city to make it more of a welcoming community center. So we currently have some options, but we're just going to kind of sort of wait and see what the citizens want.
You've talked a little bit in the past about the availability of electronic services so that people don't have to come into City Hall mm-hmm. physically as much in the future. It's getting into a more 21st century way of interacting with your local government, whereas mm-hmm. in the past, the idea of you'd walk your water bill down to City Hall and you'd hand it in. Obviously, people don't want to do that now. Mm-hmm. Does this present you that opportunity, and are you talking more about the idea of how you can have perhaps as little physical space mm-hmm. donated to this idea as possible, and how much more you might be able to accomplish by adding additional electronic services?
Oh, absolutely. We have, you know, in Y2K plus 15 now, we try to make sure that we are, you know, keeping up with the times. And, you know, West Lafayette as a population is pretty unique. We got a lot of really smart people that are really in tune with technology. And we like to make our services as accessible as possible. So being able to pay bills online, being able to get information from specific departments and department heads online, we think is critical to help communicate our message as local government. And it allows for us to be basically providing, you know, more timely services. But the actual physical structure itself, conceptually, you think of a downtown area and you think of a government center. But what's inside that government center, I think, is up to some debate. You know, we will always have public meetings. We will always have council meetings. We will always have redevelopment commission and Board of Works meetings and all those. So we do need to have a meeting place. Right now we use the Morton multipurpose room for that specific purpose. Which is nice. I mean, it's nice having it down there. It's nice having it so accessible and people know where it is. But as a functional room, it really isn't that great. We have to set it up and tear it down after every meeting, which involves a lot of staff time. One of the ideas that's been floating around now is just, you know, leaving, you know, having a small office area, but then having a communal meeting space somewhere centrally located in the city to where we would have all those meetings and maybe have some small offices within that structure. Then we could fully geek out the building so we could have all the technology in there. We could be able to transmit our meetings through whatever media is going to be available at that time and yet have a focal point where people can go, not just for the city meetings, but also to be used for other public meetings as needed. That's one concept that's going on out there. But right now, we're sort of in a holding pattern. We know one thing for sure. We're going to go ahead and remove the structure on Navajo, scrape it, and then we're going to figure out what the public wants from that point forward.
We're talking with West Lafayette Mayor John Dennis today on WBAA's Ask the Mayor, and we'd like to have your questions here in our next half hour or so. Phone them in to 765-496-1999. Email them to ask@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. So I've been working on a story for the last couple of days about what's holding up the transition to the new train service for mm-hmm. the Hoosier State Amtrak line. And I know the mayors have been involved in this process. Mm-hmm. I've talked with Todd Barton this week from Crawfordsville about it. What is your sense of why this week the deadline, soft as it was not met?
I don't know. I know that's not a very politically astute answer to take. You know, we've been going back and forth with Amtrak, with Iowa Pacific. We've been working with our elected officials, both locally, federally, and statewide, to see what it is that we as a community, and I'm not speaking exclusively for Greater Lafayette, but for all the communities on that particular rail spur, what we need to do to preserve this route. And we have been able to overcome a lot of hurdles. I mean, most recently, the budget item was removed from this year's budget. And between Mayor Rozworski, myself, and Commissioner Tom Murtaugh with the county, we were able to make some phone calls and get that placed back into the budget. But the presumption is that it's a finger route that is the most subsidized route within the Amtrak rail system, and it's most least used. So it's a hard sell sometimes for us to make. And I think oftentimes whenever another financial or operational hurdle comes up, I think some of those old debates sort of resurface and it challenges somebody's belief system in this entire project. But we feel, and you've, again, this almost is like a replay of what we've talked about a few months ago, we feel that it's critically important for our community. You know, in Greater Lafayette, we've got 40,000 students that live here. We are very dependent upon public transportation. We feel that we're a progressive community, and we believe very strongly in that rail spur. But the fact of the matter is that it's not just us. You know, we are codependent upon other communities and now with Iowa Pacific, other operators. So to be able to pinpoint one specific cause for the hurry up stop concept with everything moving forward, it's difficult to identify. But I think that there's just some degree of reticence on the part of some of the participants in making this move forward because it seems to be conceptually an easy thing to do. So it's beyond my understanding as well. We take two steps forward then one step back.
I was on the phone this morning with Will Wingfield, a spokesman for NDOT, who described himself sort of as one of the mediators as NDOT's role between Iowa Pacific and, mm-hmm. and Amtrak. And Will says, look, this is something we do all the time. We constantly have to balance multiple different constituencies who mm-hmm. want different things. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the conversations you've been privy to, specifically between the mayors and NDOT and mm-hmm. Iowa Pacific? What are these actors like in the conversations that you have?
Well, everybody is enthusiastic about continuing the service. That's what's so ironic. Everybody wants this to happen. Iowa Pacific, I mean, Mr. Ellis is very enthusiastic about it, obviously as a private contractor. He sees this as an opportunity unlike others that he's been involved with. In his mind, he really believes that we're going to be able to get a system that's been somewhat neglected, polish it up, make it efficient, make it effective, make it pleasant, provide services within the cars, and make it a very popular and profitable transportation route. The folks at NDOT, they sort of embrace our enthusiasm, and they seem to be supportive as well. Whereas Iowa Pacific's kind of like a single source or single agended entity, NDOT's got a lot of stuff to do. They got a lot of bridges. They got a lot of roads. And as I've been told in many of my conversations, their money's very busy working for itself right now. And up until we started having this statewide conversation about our rail service, I don't think NDOT really considered trains to be part of their responsibility. So there was a learning curve. There was the willingness to embrace what we in this community specifically and the rest of the communities on the route believe to be a valuable community asset. And again, when you talk about quality of life, which elected officials often do, that's something that you want to plug into that. The multimodal transportation concept, having different options to get from point A to point B, is a pretty cool thing for a community to have. So we want to hang on to it as long as we can. And again, I'm sure you've heard, if you've talked to Arvid Olsen, if you've talked to anybody that's been involved in this project, you realize that passenger rail around the world is something that they consider to be the, no pun intended, but the golden spike of positive community input and output, because you get folks to actually use transportation and get off the roads that are so congested now. It's a much more efficient way to get around. So again, long-winded way to say, you know, I think that there's just, you got a lot of people pulling on the same side of the rope until that rope gets too slippery to hang on to.
One thing you didn't mention there was your conversations with Amtrak. Tell me about how you've interacted with either Joe Boardman, the head of Amtrak, mm-hmm. or Mark Maglieri, the spokesman. How has Amtrak seemed in all of this? Because, of course, this is a group of people, an organization that is giving up some measure mm-hmm. of at least its control or its prestige mm-hmm. in running this line. It's still going to be their people, but it's not going to be their Amtrak-branded equipment
Correct.
Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see a way clear to saying Amtrak may not be all that enthusiastic about doing what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Does it seem that way to you?
Yeah, we actually, when we go to D.C. just this past February, when we were in D.C., we met with Joe and his team at Amtrak. And that's specifically what he said, because we started pursuing the quality of car. We started pursuing, you know, the situations that happened at the rail crossings. We started pursuing the reliability and the dependability of the routes and the times. And, you know, Joe was very polite. And he had some really great responses, as did his team. But Joe also brought up the fact that he said, hey, guys, remember, you know, we're basically asked to subsidize our competitors on our rails. And when you look at that as a business model, it's really not, it doesn't make a great deal of sense. So we respect the fact of what he's doing. We appreciate that. But he didn't dissuade from the fact that he wants to see this happen. He didn't say, so that's why we're going to lay down and just kind of let things go. He seemed to be very supportive of making sure that that route continues. So I think that Amtrak as a rule, you know, wants to see their business continue.
But the enthusiasm is somewhat tempered.
Yeah, I would, you know, again, I'm just being a human being, you would think that that would be the case. But we haven't felt anything negative coming from Amtrak towards us about this particular spur.
Let me ask you about the money aspect of it, because Greater Lafayette is one of the larger financial players in terms of paying into this agreement from mm-hmm. all of the cities. Mm-hmm. Crawfordsville is going to pay about 15%. Mm-hmm. And the way that that number is arrived at, Mayor Todd Barton told me, is you look at ridership from sure. each individual place.
Mm-hmm.
Although I wonder if that's not completely backwards, because if Greater Lafayette supplies, say, 50% of the riders, mm-hmm. then aren't you also supplying a large portion of the revenue that's already going into this line?
Mm-hmm.
And shouldn't you be able to say, look, we are already pulling our weight mm-hmm. financially with this. Why are you double dipping?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what, as you say, it's a double-edged sword. You know, they look at where the concentration of ridership is, which basically, in it, depending upon how you look at it, would determine who would be in a greater need. And so I think that they use the need as an opportunity for us to financially participate. You know, the ridership numbers, although they are very high here, to the point where we're really appreciative and we can show that it's a valuable asset here. I think that, again, when you look at it from an elected guy's perspective, there is that political pressure to make sure that this thing stays. And fortunately, we all support it, you know, philosophically as well as financially.
Well, and Dyer doesn't support it financially.
Not anymore. They pulled out. Exactly right. Exactly right. But Dyer, even at the beginning of the conversations, they were not overly enthusiastic about this route continuing, even though they are a stop on the route. And I believe, and I could be wrong, but I believe Dyer just invested a significant amount of money in their rail station there. Or did Amtrak pay for that?
I don't know.
Okay,
but either way, all sides say mm-hmm. they don't supply enough riders to be mm-hmm. much of a factor.
Right. Right. So, Dyer does not. Yeah.
Right.
But we do. And I think that's why we're so, you know, we feel that as public servants, we're going to continue this as best as we can.
We mentioned at the outset of all of this conversation on Ask the Mayor today that you have just been you're going to be reinstalled as mayor. No one's running against you. And yet it was interesting to me that even though that was all but a foregone conclusion, a couple of days ago, you held your annual golf fundraiser.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Where does that money go now? I mean, you don't need it to run an election campaign.
Yeah, we're actually going to make private donations to the rail system just to see if it.
Well, somebody ought
to. I'm joking, Stan. No, actually.
Now that you've said it, you're on the record now.
I'm on your record. And that would be a big bang for my contributors, wouldn't it? No, the fact of the matter is that most elected officials, they have some event to generate revenue for their campaign. And the money that's not used to go specifically into the campaign can go into other things. If you want to support another candidate, you can contribute there. If you want to do some sort of investment in another, you know, something that would be sanctioned from your donors. The golf outings, at least mine, I can only speak for myself. They're not that big. You know, we don't generate, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars like you would if you're going to do a state or a national campaign. Basically, we have a target amount that we shoot for. If we get it each year, that's great. And we usually use it to support, you know, our campaign or other elected officials' campaigns.
Do you have specific elected officials you're going to target with the money?
Not right now. We'll go ahead. Usually what we'll do is we'll look at the council candidates. When that gets sorted out, we'll see if we can assist the council candidates, those sort of things.
And
but generally speaking, it's usually local. I mean, we don't, you know, farm it out anywhere else.
You've got a number of unopposed people who mm-hmm. are running for the council as well.
Mm-hmm.
There's at least one council race where you've got an independent, a Democrat, and a Republican running. Would you see that that's a more competitive race, and would you perhaps funnel money more towards something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, over the past 8 years, we've been pretty consistent with our elected officials. We've had pretty much the same group working for the community for the past 8 years. And we feel that we've done a pretty good job. I'm pretty proud of my team at what we've been able to achieve over the past 8 years. And the odd thing about elections and election cycles is sometimes you can get folks that are going to help you pull on the same side of the rope, again, to use the old cliche, or you can get those that are going to be obstructionists. And this is apolitical. I mean, this is a situation where you just want to make sure the right people are going to be in place to do the right thing for the community. And a lot of that will come through the campaign process, you know, depending upon you look at their platform, depending upon what they're talking about and what they're speaking for specifically, that is usually what empowers us to make a decision as to how well they're going to fit in with this existing teamwork model. And so right now, you know, nobody's really come out to say a whole lot. You know, it's been a pretty quiet political season, mostly because there's not been any primaries. So,
well, and I think there are a lot of people that are also looking forward to 2016. I think mm-hmm. there's been a general overlooking of 2015 because I look at the mayors who are on this program. Three mm-hmm. of the four of you don't even have opponents mm-hmm. in November. And so that's a lot of races that you don't even have to pay mm-hmm. attention to anymore. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you about that idea, because I think there are people who would say you have a very interesting, for instance, gubernatorial race mm-hmm. coming up next year, potentially mm-hmm. interesting. Mm-hmm. Although there are people I think you could argue the other way around, which is, hey, you're just going to wind up with some of the same people we had in 2012. Why should we care?
Yeah.
And so there are people like you who have some amount of money in their war chest mm-hmm. who could be influential in these discussions, who mm-hmm. could try to find an interesting candidate or perhaps even a dark horse that nobody's thought about mm-hmm. to support that person, give them some seed money. And so it's a matter of where your influence goes. Are you better served giving the money to people you already know, the status quo you've said on the West Lafayette Council? There's mm-hmm. already stability there. You know what you're going to get. Mm-hmm. And yet you have been critical of state government. You've mm-hmm. been critical of Governor Pence. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be worth your while to spend some of this money finding somebody to run for that post who perhaps you better align yourself with?
Well, the difficulty with that is that oftentimes when, and let's just use golf outings as an example. And again, I'm not a very political guy. I understand a lot about it. I understand operations very well, but politics sometimes doesn't make much sense to me. But the fact of the matter is that when we invite people to our golf outing, they are there to support the candidate. They're to support me. And if they're generous enough to write a check to me, then the presumption is they don't want me to take that money and do something else with it.
I disagree. I think they write a check to you, and anytime you've done this, anytime you've made a gift to somebody, if it's truly a gift and you're giving it to that person, mm-hmm. then you're trusting them to do what you think is sensible with the money. Mm-hmm. But the key is that you're trusting in that person. Mm-hmm. So anybody who writes a check to you is freely giving that money over to you, saying, I believe John will do something smart with this money. It does not necessarily mean that you're going to use it for your campaign. It means that you have the additional influence of their cash mm-hmm. to do something smart with it. Mm-hmm. So I think it gives you great freedom to do whatever you could do the most good with that money.
Mm-hmm. Well, and my belief system is that they're giving it to me to be responsible for it. And I don't know.
Right, but again, one of the responsibilities is spending the money how you see fit.
Well, I know, but hypothetically, let's say that you know, I took all the money that I made off my golf outing and gave it to a congressional candidate or a senatorial candidate. But some of the donors could say, wait a second, you know, I wrote the check says to John Dennis or, you know, John Dennis for mayor campaign. It doesn't say to Stan for running for governor. You could have a bit of an issue about that. And again, when this is local. It's local government, and my specific fundraisers are for local government. And so I believe that the money that I earn is going to basically be used in the local government political season.
Well, but practically speaking, there are a couple of issues there. One, yes, they're writing it to your campaign mm-hmm. fund. Mm-hmm. And so it gets lumped into a larger pot of money, which gets spent on a variety of different things, whether it's buying yard signs with your name on it mm-hmm. or whether it's going to support other candidates. if they're so naive that they believe it's going straight to you, well, that's their problem. That's naivete on the part of people who are writing you checks, and you can't be responsible for that, and neither can anyone else be. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there are lots of candidates who start in local office. Mm-hmm. Plenty of local mayors have run for higher office.
Oh, yeah.
And plenty of people who have been on city councils have run for higher office. Mm-hmm. That's how the political process works. There's a hierarchy. There is some expectation, I think, that there is an experience that you gain on the local level, which you move up to the state level, which you move up to the federal level. And so isn't it reasonable to think that those people, again, would not be so naive to realize that the process works this way and that you could then spend the money to help a local candidate, yourself or someone else, do whatever you want?
You could, sure. But I'm talking, I think we agree, but we're talking on different levels. I'm talking about me personally. You know, I always feel that if they're generous enough to give me money for my campaign, then I try and use that money specifically for that or for my team. But I know that others do. There's a lot of mayors in this state that generate a lot of money. We generally don't. I mean, our campaigns usually, if it's a vigorous campaign, usually we can do it for about $100,000. You look at a gubernatorial campaign, and you're talking millions.
Absolutely.
So it's a different concept there. But we do. I mean, it's flattering. It really is. It's flattering when your name is on a banner and somebody's willing to contribute to continue to keep you employed. That's kind of a neat thing. But overall, you know, locally, it's I'm not being approached by other elected officials at a state or federal level for money.
Did you make less money this year because people knew you were unopposed?
No, we generally make a pretty consistent amount each year.
So it relates perhaps more to your relative popularity with the electorate versus John needs the extra money because he knows he's going to have to wage a campaign against somebody.
Or because his water heater broke and he needs to buy another one. No, of course. It's generally they're being supportive of our particular philosophy, how we've been able to, you know, the progress that we've made in the community. And they are enthusiastic about it, and they'd like for us to stick around.
You don't have to tell me how much money you've got, but can you tell me whether in your last couple of election cycles you've been able to build that war chest, or is it that you take in the money and you generally dole out a similar amount of money?
Yeah, we play it pretty close. We generally spend about as much as we have each year on different things. You know, there's some things, you know, that the campaign supports that we usually try and keep pretty consistent with that. Now, obviously, we don't spend all of it. So there is a revolving fund that sits in there and it grows a little bit, but not to the point where there's, you know, anybody could retire on it.
And has anyone come asking for your financial assistance, knowing that you have had this golf outing or any other fundraiser that you might
had? Yeah. I mean, you know, again, when you look at it politically, there are certain folks within your local community that are going to be on your team, and that they don't have the name recognition. They don't necessarily have the political experience. And so, sure, you'll help them out a little bit.
All right. Well, I've probably grilled you enough for 1 month, and we'll let you have a nice July 4th off, hopefully, and we'll do it again next month.
Well, and remember, this is a unique July 4th because we're actually hosting the July 4th celebration here in West Lafayette at Slater Center on Saturday. So,
hope to
see you there.
Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks so much for your time, as always.
Thank you, Stan.
This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Remember that all these programs are archived at our website, WBAA.org. And join us next week for our conversation with Lafayette Mayor Tony Rzeworski. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Have a good rest of your day.
Support for Ask the Mayor on WBAA comes from your membership and Butler, Fairman & Seifert, a civil engineering firm providing communities with professional expertise and guidance. Butler, Fairman & Seifert, civil engineering solutions for better communities. BFSENGR.com.